everyone, and welcome to another episode of To See or Not To See. I am your host, Grace Curley, and today I will be analysing and discussing my experience of one of the most important films ever made. La Dolce Vita, meaning The Sweet Life, is a 1960s Italian film directed by Federico Fellini, a pioneer in the golden age of neorealism, often depicting the tragic frailty of the human condition in a postmodern world. It is widely hailed as one of the most important films of all time, but why? When people mention how this film is a timeless masterpiece, they mention its portrayal of a glamorous and corrupt Roman society, depicting the inner decay of the decadent so-called high life in an age of mass consumerism and tabloids. And while this is a huge part of it, I will be exploring this concept on a larger scale by interpreting the symbolism, subtext, and contrast that it subtly and masterfully employs, and its devices of portraying happiness as a commodified ideal, people as both victims and exploiters, and how the true sweetness of life has actually been brutalized and barbarized out of the human experience. Because of the sheer genius of this film, this episode will be split into two parts. Stay tuned! La Dolce Vita portrays life as a cosmic joke. We, as the viewers, are not treated as viewers. Throughout the duration of the film, I admit it is painful sitting through it. It drags on, seemingly insignificant things happen, dialogue is often unnecessary, pseudo-intellectual or vapid, and it really seems like a whole purposeless waste of time. And therein lies the true purpose. Instead of being voyeurs into a cinematic scope of indifference, we are put into the very shoes of the protagonist, Marcello, a gossip journalist who is internally disgusted with the people he encounters, yet cannot seem to extricate himself from them, and perhaps doesn't even want to. It seems that Marcello exists in a state of purgatory between succumbing to sinful desires and ineffectively attempting to capture genuine happiness. It's a perpetual state of emptiness that Marcello himself has put himself in. We question the content of this film, we suffer through it, we judge the spoilt, meaningless lives of the rich and degenerate, we become tired, crazed by the end of it, because surely this is not all there is. Surely there is a reason for this film. It cannot be this egocentric, pretentious, and self-indulgent, directionless film for people to claim it one of the best films in the world. I admit, I thought all of this at first, but as I made these judgments, I answered my own questions. We are all Marcello. He drags himself through life like we drag ourselves through this film. He observes every class and body of people and maintains that they are all just as unhappy and empty as the other. He is aware of the futility of all of them, the vapid degeneration of modern society, the egocentric self-glorifying of people pretending to be interesting and wise as if they are the first ones to have a human thought, and the hysteria that possesses people into twisted versions of a human. Marcello knows all of this, yet he continues to hang out with these people. He knows this, yet he willingly walks himself into the jungle, filled with mobs of mad animals, all decaying and killing each other. A cacophony of noise and racket and screams, all futile, all useless, a screech for help. While Marcello knows this, he doesn't do anything to stop it. He doesn't leave or voice an opinion. In fact, he always attends. He is never actually enjoying himself, yet he never misses a gathering. Just like us, we are aware of the sickly and unresolute nature of this film, yet we continue to watch it. Not because we are interested per se, or because we think this film will have something significant to say by the end, or because we are enjoying ourselves. We stay because it is better to be miserable than go, unseeing and unknowing as one of the mob. At the very beginning of the film, a statue of Jesus is being flown from a helicopter toward Vatican City, the supposed epicenter of God's favor and the symbol of divine spirit. Bikini-clad girls sunbathing on a roof ask Marcello in an adjacent helicopter where they are taking it, but he cannot hear them over the loud whirring of the helicopter. Instead, he asks them for their phone numbers. This scene seemingly contributes nothing to the storyline and is never revisited or talked about, yet it is the opening of this quintessential movie. Why? Because it serves as the metaphor that sets the overarching tone of this film, that we as humans have made a mockery of all things good and pure and noble in this world. We do worse than ignore it or condemn it. We take it and defile it and gentrify it, distort it and generalize it until it has completely lost its meaning, until it is as good and valuable as trash on the street. We take the things that matter the most and beat them down with sticks until they are unrecognizable. Then we coat a layer of paint over it, string some diamonds along its neck, and we call it beauty. We call it religion. We call it elegance and art and philosophy. We call it life. It is a shell of what it was, and the shell is what we worship and try to recreate. We become the shell. So the film takes place over a week-long period in episodic scenes depicting 7 different scenarios observed and participated in by Marcello. And one of the main things I noticed is that it constantly contrasts and compares sacred symbolism with that of shallowness, damnation, blasphemy, and hypocrisy. This is found, as I mentioned earlier, in the removal of the statue of Christ from the city, and also in an episode where the children's frantic search for the sighted Virgin Mary goes unfound as the search ruptures into chaos and mass hysteria in the televised fake miracle, and also through Marcello's relationship with his intellectual friend Steiner. Steiner is first presented to us in a church where he asks Marcello about his book and gently encourages him to continue writing. He then asks a priest if he can play the organ. It leads into him perfectly playing Bach's Toccata and Fugue. When he plays it, he becomes wide-eyed and questioning, almost grim. "We are not used to hearing these sounds anymore," he says. "Such a mysterious voice. It seems to come from inside the earth." But when Marcello hears it, he is impatient, as if waiting for it to end, as if a little afraid to really listen to it, afraid of what he might feel, of what he might see. The look on his face makes you think that he is remembering something he hasn't thought about in years, something that lies deep beneath his skin, something he prefers not to see and not to feel, that there is perhaps something not so sweet about his glamorous life after all. He then turns around and stands in the doorframe before looking back at Steiner again, like a spectator craning his neck at the shining thing, admiring it from afar, but too apprehensive to actually join it, to look at it up close. The next time we see Steiner, it is at one of his intellectual evening parties where Marcello attends with his girlfriend Emma. Steiner puts on a record where he has recorded various nature sounds simply because he thought they were beautiful, and the company listens to it in vague confusion, trying to make out each sound. Emma points out each one. "Birds! That's exactly the way they sound! And this is a forest!" Instead of listening to the beauty, that is the unobstructed, unpolluted, natural world, they must divide, label, and dilute everything so that it is minimized enough for their selective minds to understand in theory. Marcello envies Steiner's position and is contemptuous of his own, noting how Steiner is a man of substance, refinement, and consciousness. But Steiner replies sharply, "Don't be like me. Salvation doesn't lie within 4 walls. I'm too serious to be a dilettante. Dante and too much of a dabbler to be a professional. Even the most miserable life is better than a sheltered existence in an organized society where everything is calculated and perfected." He wanders to his children's bedroom and kisses them lovingly as they sleep, worrying about the future they will face. This theme of hypocrisy is mirrored in Marcello's relationship with his own father when he comes to visit. Marcello is distant from him, but nonetheless desires to pursue a deeper relationship with him. However, his father is resistant to it because he, too, lives the same life Marcello does. He lived a life of no commitment, womanizing indifference and meaningless decadence. So naturally, he neglected family and neglected Marcello. And naturally, Marcello grew to resent his father for all those things, without realizing that he was growing to become just like him. And in a way, his father also symbolizes the death of his hope. Because here he was, an old man, and still leading the same meaningless life he led 30 years ago. He marks the stagnancy that Marcello is afraid of, yet is too weak to remove himself from. His father has never amounted to anything and never changed his ways. Perhaps that is the reason Marcello tries to actively reach out to his father, asking him to stay in Rome after he had a health scare, to see if there was a possibility of change, of possible connection, even at his father's polarized state. "We never see each other," Marcello says, but his father doesn't even seem to hear him. Another moment, joining the endless theme of words falling on deaf ears. Then perhaps this is the only moment of true hurt in this film, one of Marcello's real emotions, hurt, that his father does not love him, that he would rather retreat back into his shell of impotence and self-pity and aging degeneration. Fear, perhaps, because Marcello knows that he would do the same thing. That hope he might have held is gone with his father. This futility and failure of relationships is another constant theme and is here brought to a climax when Marcello gets the call that Steiner, his friend, that he had held in the rarest and highest regard, had committed suicide and not only destroyed himself, but his kids along with him. The only character who was truly a man of grace and wisdom, a man of God, a conscious parent, was the only man to see the world for what it truly was, so much so that he removed his beloved kids from the world, believing them to be too pure, too good for this wasteland we call Earth, that he knew would eventually and slowly suck the life out of them, as it does to everyone. This dramatic event in a generally slow-paced film shocked us as the viewers, as it shocked Marcello. But did that change him? Did that event become the catalyst of Marcello's awakening? No. It took away the last sliver of hope he had been holding on to, snuffed out the last flame of faith, because if a man like Steiner could not be happy or be at peace, then how could anyone, let alone Marcello, achieve such faraway ideals? After the tragic event, there is a scene that shows hordes of paparazzi trying to bombard Steiner's wife before she even heard about the incident. This portrays the inhumane and objectified commodification of human emotions and grief, that the insufficiency of the masses twists anything real into a mutilated figure of bloated, saturated, putrid spectacle. The next episode shows Marcello and his mistress Maddalena surrounded by rich socialites pouncing around a supposedly haunted castle. One of the women gets possessed and starts to writhe on a table as people try to hold her down. "I want life," she screams harrowingly. But the truth is, they are all possessed. Possessed by the distorted fragments of themselves that try to piece together a mangled consciousness. Possessed by the very system that exploits them, that they too have become the exploiters of. They all want life, yet they are too weak to grasp it. Even those without ignorance, like Marcello, are doomed to suffer. Knowledge without means of action is the ultimate doom, like sinking in the ocean with your legs tied with weights, yet you know how to swim. You have everything you need to save yourself, yet you cannot. They live a facsimile of life, a pretty imitation, yet that is all it is, an imitation, not real. They do all the right things of living. They have fun, they drink, laugh, dance, philosophize, they have sex, all of the things usually required for a satisfying and liberating life they do. Yet none of these things, no matter how frequent they perform them, can ever amount to anything real. Because every action and every thought is being manufactured by a false ego, a desperate, greedy thing that desires the results without the work. He would rather look happy than be happy. Finally, in the final scene out of the 7 episodes, Marcello attends a beachside orgy. It is full of writhing, hedonistic degenerates. They all have that sickly look about them, that buzzed-out, glassy-eyed, vampiric deficiency. The song on the radio, Patricia, is the same one that played earlier in the film when Marcello visited a beach bar to write his infamous novel and met a young adolescent waitress named Paola. She was fascinated with him, and he became fascinated by her youth, her uncorrupted purity and vitality, the natural unsaid spark that propels her, that spark which is unmitigated life, but distilled here in essence. She symbolized the cool breath of innocence, organic life, and renewal. Yet at this orgy, the song Patricia is played on an organ, a callback to Steiner playing Bach in the church, but in this place, a parody. This reflection is seemingly lost on Marcello as he is beyond recollection or reflection. He gazes ahead at the orgiastic bacchanalia, a microcosm of bestial hedonism, perversion, and parasitic decay. There is vague, detached disgust on his face, before it morphs into one of empty resignation, one of submission, the unmistakable look of hope draining away every last drop. Here we know Marcello has expedited his degeneration and his disintegration. With each flicker of hope gone, propelled by Steiner's tragic actions, he can only face the music. But he can barely recognize anything anymore, let alone himself, so he becomes one of the monkeys in the zoo, perpetually high on the cocaine of impotence and amusement, becoming one of the grotesque, reptilian, hysterical mass unconsciousness. His life gone, because what use is life if it has no meaning? A drunk girl starts a striptease, and Marcello begins to rip open the pillows, throwing the chicken feathers on her. But she doesn't stop, and instead continues to dance more primitively. He already sees them all as animals, and he is only making her look more like herself. He covers her in the feathers to peel away the facade, to show what is writhing underneath. He feels angry at this fraudulence, so he liberates it from her. He continues to throw the feathers in the air so they land on everyone, and his face in this moment is pleasant and open, as if he is convinced he is doing these people a miraculous favor, a remarkably kind act of service. When they go outside, it is dawn, and they are all running out to the beach when they see a great dead shark washed up on the shores. They all surround it, remarking at how ugly it is and how its eyes insist on looking, because it is a terrible reminder and reflection of their true states. This carcass symbolizes all of them, how they live in this illusion of decadence and high life, but are all, truly, dead inside, slippery and deformed, like this dead fish. When one looks at this dead beast, the words from Yeats's Second Coming come to mind. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. The fish is an ancient symbol for Christ, so this creature parallels the beginning of the film with the statue of Jesus in the air. It mocks the second coming of Christ as this dead fish, this bloated thing, mutilated by its own species. Another reference to the hypocrisy, defilement, and mockery of the sacred. Earlier in the film, Steiner had said, "Sometimes at night, the darkness and silence weighs on me. Peace frightens me. Perhaps I fear it most of all. I feel it's only a facade, hiding the face of hell." Peace frightens people most of all, so they will do everything they can to avoid it, with distractions, with the numbing or the overloading of the senses. Steiner is right. All this a facade for what is truly underneath, the face of hell, a mangled, rotten carcass with dead, beady eyes. And Marcello cannot look for long. He must turn away, as expected. And that is when he sees the girl waving at him from the other side of the beach. It is the girl from the beach bar, Paola, his Umbrian angel, and she is cupping her hands around her mouth, yelling something to him. But Marcello cannot hear her over the rushing of the waves, so he gives up. He turns back to the crowd, the unhearing mass. He turns his back on renewal, on truth, on goodness, on purity. He turns his back on life. Marcello fears commitment as it might stop him from discovering the sweet life, but by not pursuing happiness, he has prevented himself from ever achieving the sweet life. Too much distraction used to fill the void, stuffing our ears so we cannot hear anything else. This theme bookends the film, like in the opening scene with Christ's statue where he cannot hear the girls over the noise of the helicopter, and now with the angel calling his name, and him not being able to hear her and giving up. But the film does not end there. The camera zooms in on a shot of the girl's face looking ahead at Marcello, at his retreating figure. She is smiling like a knowing Raphaelite angel. Then she turns her gaze directly into the camera, looking at us. Her gaze, so free of judgment, renders us, the viewers, as part of the picture. We are no longer just bystanders to a collage of scenes. We are participants in our own lives, propelled by choice and action. We can choose to be Marcello and succumb to the hysteria, or we can make a different choice. Do we hear her or not? La dolce vita, the sweetness of life, self-indulgence, self-satisfaction, a satire of the eroded, poisonous minds of the human psyche made economical by society. The reason this film is timeless is because of how it can apply to all eras of life, including now. People projecting an imitation of a high lifestyle, a false ideal on social media, despite living a lie, wanting others to think they are happy, successful, woke, having fun, without actually achieving any of those things, preferring instead the image and the imitation of those things. Nobody can relax because of this constant self-surveillance, this lack of intimacy, honesty, and privacy. We are our own voyeurs. This film has also been suggested as allegorical to Dante's Inferno, in that the protagonist goes through a journey through hell, meets and observes all of the inhabitants on its different levels, and makes it to the other side. Except, in Marcello's case, he never reaches the light at the end of the tunnel. He allows the dead souls to claw at him, tug him into their needy arms, making him, eventually, one of them. Unlike Dante, he does not make it out of hell alive. There are 7 episodical scenes, each portraying different classes of people creating their own unhappiness, no matter how high in society they are. They are all united by one thing, their mutual lack of meaning. Just like there are 7 episodes, there are 7 deadly sins. Pride, sloth, greed, envy, lust, gluttony, and wrath, all individually manifested in the 7 episodes. Like Inferno, Marcello starts the film in paradise, when he is up in the air with Christ, descends to purgatory, and then finally finds himself in hell, where he cannot escape. And after all, doesn't this seem just like one great, big, divine comedy? Next episode, I will be continuing the discussion of Marcello's relationship with the women in this film, the feminine archetypes it perpetuates, and the biblical interpretations of such archetypes. Thank you for listening to another episode of To See or Not to See. I am your host, Grace Curley. What did you see or not see? That is the question.